Welcome to Ira's Everything Bagel, where I talk with intriguing people about everything, their passions, pursuits, and points of view. We've built cities for ourselves, but it turns out we're not the only ones living in them. Wildlife has found remarkable ways to adapt to our urban world. What can these surprising neighbors teach us about evolution, resilience, and even ourselves? My guest is award-winning writer and social epidemiologist Dan Werb. He's author of Our Wild Familiars, How Animals Are Adapting to Cities and Reshaping the Natural World. We'll explore the fascinating world of synanthropes, the animals and even plants that have transformed our cities into unexpected ecosystems, and discover how they're reshaping the natural world right alongside us. I think you'll never look at your own neighborhood the same way again. Our Wild Familiars, How Animals Are Adapting to Cities and Reshaping the Natural World is available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and all the usual places. And for everything about Dan, go to Dan Werb, W-E-R-B, danwerb.com. You can follow him on Instagram and Substack. And Dan, welcome to the world. No, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
Absolutely. All right, what got you interested in this subject? It is fascinating. We're all aware that there are things that live among us and other entities that live among us, but we never really have thought through what you have presented in this book. So how did you get interested in the subject?
Yeah, I think like a lot of people, so first of all, I live in a city. The majority of the human population lives in a city, and it's easy to feel disconnected from nature, right? Like nature is something that happens elsewhere. It's not near me. It's definitely not accessible through my city or in my neighborhood. And then that was compounded with the pandemic, right? Where, coming out of the pandemic, I feel like people were even more disconnected and felt this sense of isolation. And so I've written a couple books. My last one was about the pandemic. The one before that was about sort of a situation around the health and safety of women in Tijuana, all from a scientific epidemiologic lens. And for this book, I really wanted to do something that helped me reconnect with the natural world. And I came across this word that you said, synanthrope, in the research for my last book. And it just stuck with me, right? Like I'm a writer. I hear a word. If it sounds good, that's good enough for me. Right. You know, in the case of synanthrope, I looked into it. And as you say, like this is a class of animals that is defined by the fact that they live side by side with human beings in human modified environments. And, you know, it just sparked something in me, right? Where you hear that word and almost immediately it was like, oh my God, there's something else happening in the world right around me. And maybe this is a pathway into more connection, not just with nature, but, you know, with other creatures and feeling like, you know, a sense of belonging in the world. And that was certainly the case in the research I did for this book.
I just came up with a new title for you, which would be Beyond Dogs and Cats.
Yes, that's exactly it.
We're very comfortable with dogs and cats, but then when you get into other areas, as some of the species I talked about, you may get a little bit uncomfortable, but the reality is they're there. So once you decided this would be an interesting topic to write about and research, how did you develop the research for it? How did you structure it so that you can approach it in a way that is accessible for readers to get a sense of all of this fascinating world? Again, it's called Our Wild Familiars, How Animals Are Adapting to Cities and Reshaping the Natural World.
Yeah, it was really the research kind of was done in three steps. The first was interviews with people who are, you know, like urban ecologists, biologists, epidemiologists, exterminators, veterinarians, like anybody whose path crossed with animals, in one case, an architect who has been designing these sort of these public art pieces that look like these beautiful artistic sculptures, but are actually sort of somewhat secretly habitats for bats and birds and insects. And just learning about how they understand the world and how they've approached, you know, this issue or this phenomenon of urban animals. Then it was just diving headfirst into the scientific research. So, you know, I checked my library of kind of peer-reviewed studies, and there are 599 peer-reviewed studies that I read for this book and really just like marinating in that research. And then, you know, the most important thing was doing field research. So traveling to cities, traveling to places that had been affected by animals, where animals had adapted in interesting ways, and just learning firsthand, you know, like being coming face to face with animals and in urban environments and understanding, you know, almost trying to get into that perspective from an animal's perspective of what an urban environment feels like and how they've adapted to it.
Well, the most unscientific question I have for you, but it's the most important one. Did you get bitten?
Did I get bitten? No, I did not get bitten. I mean, like maybe I got an insect bite, but I was not bitten by anything, any vertebrate, that's for sure. Yeah, I mean, the interesting thing about urban animals is like on the one hand, we kind of like in the case of rats, for instance, we're like we fear them, but there's already this balance in place. Like even with rats, even despite their overpopulation, it's quite rare to be to come into conflict with urban animals. Historically, I will say that, you know, that might be changing a little bit. Like there's one urban animal that has kind of emerged over the past 20 years, which is the coyote, which is super prevalent in a lot of cities that it was never seen in before. And we hear these, you know, still quite rare, but very newsworthy stories of coyotes attacking pets, certainly, and sometimes children and things like that. But no, I would say that like on balance, like I was certainly not bitten. Most people will never be bitten. But I think on the other hand, you know, this book is a celebration of connection with animals in urban spaces and a celebration of cities as ecosystems in their own right. But that doesn't mean to say that there aren't issues and strategies that we should be employing to make sure that that balance remains and that we're able to accommodate all kinds of interesting species in our day-to-day world.
Did you think initially that one of your objectives would be to remove the fear factor? You mentioned rats, for example, and the coexistence that goes on there. But was one of your objectives to demystify and defear, if that's a word, people from rats and other animals and species?
You know, to be honest, Ira, like my main focus was on connection. I wasn't really thinking so much about fear. I was thinking more, honestly, about despair. And I think a lot of people, myself included, you know, you look at climate change and these global forces that seem to be slowly just destroying the planet, and you can very quickly fall into despair about the state of the world. But what I learned talking to people who study urban animals is there is like a real lack of nostalgia, right? These are people who see cities, they're not necessarily judging humans for acting a certain way. They're not seeing cities as these nightmarish blights on the land. They're just seeing cities as what they are, right? Which is just ecosystems. You don't need nostalgia. You don't need to start from a, you know, sadness about a bygone era. And in fact, that can get in the way of appreciating the connections and the elegance and complexity of the adaptations that animals have undergone to live near us. And I really appreciated that, right? Like, so for me, it's really a book about building a sense of optimism and connection instead of leaning into this sort of obscure, vague despair about climate change and feeling like that stops you from being able to do anything to make the world a better place. And in fact, you know, when we look at cities as what they are, which are places that are often more biodiverse than the areas that surround them, that can be really clarifying. That, you know, you can start thinking about cities as sites of conservation and think about them as places that are worth saving and worth building and designing and fostering to create a more biodiverse planet.
So it could be, and I'll give you this, and I just want 10% royalty if you use the phrase, but almost an urban renewal for animals. It's an urban, there was another term I had and it just went right out of my brain. But in essence, it's an urban natural world is what you're describing. Because if animals of all kinds can exist within that urban world, separate from zoos, which are more of an organized human enterprise, but if they can live among us and with us and we with them, it becomes a new urban natural world.
Yeah, and look, like we, when you realize the sheer breadth of the diversity around you, you can't help but be connected to it. Like whether we like it or not, we participate in urban ecosystems. Like I am connected to the squirrels outside. I am connected to the pigeons. I am connected to the raccoons. I'm connected to the red-tailed hawks that hunt the pigeons that use me and other humans as human shields against those hawks, right? Like there's all these strategies that animals have employed, many of which sort of use humans in a certain way. And that is despite anything we might feel about it. And once you recognize that, I think like for me, at least, it's a really beautiful state of being because you're just one animal among many. And I'll also point out, Ira, like, you know, we're going through this period in North America that some biologists are calling the Great Urban Shift, where there are literally thousands of new species that we've never before seen in cities and towns that are moving into cities and towns at an unprecedented rate. Like this is not anything that humans have ever experienced in their history or prehistory. And so our cities are becoming even more biodiverse by the day. And the onus, I think, is increasing on recognizing cities as, again, like urban environments, legitimate natural habitats that are worth fostering and worth, putting energy into.
It sounds like it's a parallel universe of animals moving to cities because of the reasons that humans move to cities for comfort, for protection, etc. That there's a reason they're drawn to cities as opposed to toughing it out in the natural environment because it can be, there's a lot of issues with being out in the woods and the mountains, etc., even though we like nature. But if they can see that there's a benefit to coming to the city, now you have, as you mentioned, all these species coming here. But I think also, would you agree that there's a limitation on the scope of it? What I mean by that is this. We'll see bats and we'll see rats and we'll see all kinds of raccoons. You mentioned pigeons. I doubt we're going to see a large contingent of elephants in any urban environment. Because of the size.
Yeah, although... You know, there are always exceptions to the rule. There's a town in the Canadian Arctic called Churchill, Manitoba, and it lies between a hunting ground for polar bears and a hibernation area for polar bears. And it's sort of their movement, their migration is determined by when the Arctic ice freezes over. And as that's shifting, there are more and more polar bears that are basically moving into Churchill, Manitoba. And they stay there. They become kind of casual synanthropes, which means animals that spend at least part of their time in urban environments. And, you know, polar bears are pretty big creatures, right? Like these are not mice or rats. These, you cannot ignore it if a polar bear is wandering around your town, and yet they're doing it, right? Like there are stories of black bears encroaching on, you know, first dumps and then neighborhoods all over, cities and towns where in the kind of home range of black bears. And so, yeah, I'd say these, you know, what we describe as charismatic megafauna, you know, them moving into urban areas are probably in the minority of the species that are becoming urban dwellers, but they're not immune to this phenomenon either.
What happens when you mentioned about the bears? do they adapt to us or do we adapt to them? If we see a bear coming down Main Street in a town or a city, do they get used to seeing humans and therefore are not domesticated, obviously not domesticated, but they are adapting to the humans around them, or are the humans adapting to the bears around them, or are they each kind of keep their own distance?
I think it's a little of, you know, adaptation on both sides, right? If you've seen a bear roam around your town once, you're probably terrified. If you've been able to observe a bear and kind of understand its movements and understand, you know, where it's going to go and what it's going to do, you probably get a little bit more comfortable with it there, just as the bear is. This is, you know, this is a common adaptation of urban animals. You know, lots of them come in with this, what's called latent neophobia. So fear of the new. And coyotes are an excellent example of this. They are, you know, out in the wild, very skittish animals. They have intense neophobia. They do not like new things. They are skittish. They don't like being around other animals that present as potential predators or competitors. And yet, you know, a few generations of coyotes born in urban areas and they become extremely bold. They totally lose their neophobia, and they really, you know, behaviorally, they evolve to adapt to the presence of humans. Pigeons, as I mentioned, you know, another example where pigeons should be scared of us. Like, they really should. We are big, we are scary, we eat birds. And yet over time,
they run them over with a car sometimes.
Exactly. But over time they've discovered that, even if they don't realize it, that they're actually safer near humans than they are further away. Because if they're near a human, there's not going to be a red-tailed hawk that soars down and plucks them off the ground. There won't be coyotes that come and eat them whole. Humans have become human shields for pigeons. And, you know, the pigeons might not recognize that themselves in their small pigeon brains. but as a species, as an urban species, they have taken advantage in a very elegant and inspiring way, to a certain extent, I think, to make the most of the presence of humans all around them.
Well, I think the pigeons are an interesting topic because all the other ones we talked about, I understand totally, but pigeons really need to have some sort of public restroom design for them to use. Because as a homeowner or as an apartment dweller or just walking down the street, those pigeon droppings can be really annoying. But
yeah,
it's one of those things. You mentioned about behavior and the fact that these animals, in some cases, the wild familiars, as you call them, they eventually, even the coyote that is initially skittish learns about the new urban environment, adapts to it, etc. Does that then get passed on to their descendants in the sense that they teach them that, or simply when a pigeon now has a baby pigeon, does the baby pigeon model the adult pigeon or the parent pigeon and therefore learns to adapt within that urban environment, or is it left to them to just kind of discover these things themselves? Did your research show any of that?
Yeah, it's a great question. So, and I think there's a few phenomena that are happening at the same time. So one study looked at, in the case of coyotes, tried to understand what environments coyotes preferred. And so this was a structured study where coyotes that had never spent any time in urban areas before. So they were kind of coyotes that were in a wildlife preserve, were given the option of 6 different den types. And the den types ranged from totally natural, you know, grasses and wood and, you know, tall plants and things like that, those kinds of materials, totally natural materials, to completely urban materials. So, you know, metal and plastic, wood and concrete and things like that. And many of the coyotes preferred the materials of the urban environment over their natural environment. And it was the coyotes that were the most bold, that had a personality type that was already, you know, bold and aggressive that preferred the urban materials. And so what this tells us is that to a certain extent, at least in the case of coyotes, it's the bolder animals that are primed to move into cities, that appear to appreciate cities or want to make use of them in a way that the more skittish animals might not. There was a separate study also. So what that tells us is, okay, at least in the case of coyotes and probably other animals, it is the bolder animals that are coming to cities. So they're self-selecting to move into urban areas. There was another study of coyotes that was done where a pregnant mother coyote was basically, again, in not an urban dweller, not a coyote that had spent any time in cities and towns, was basically set in an enclosure next to a human. And to get to her food source, she had to walk past the human. She gave birth to a litter, and she was, you know, pretty skittish when she had to walk past the human, because she wasn't used to a human being around. Then the coyote mothers got pregnant again. And the second time, by the time that she was pregnant, or these coyotes were pregnant with their second litter, they just didn't care about the human anymore. Mm-hmm. They had no issue with the human. After the second litter was born, the biologist running this experiment compared the behavior of the first litter to the second litter and found that the second litter were far bolder than the first litter. And so, you know, on the one hand, you've got coyotes that are self-selecting to move into urban areas. But then once they're, you know, they have babies in these urban areas, what we're seeing is that this is actually a learned behavior as well, where they're becoming bolder and bolder, taking cues from the mother, from their ancestors, basically, their progenitors, to become less bold and understand that humans aren't really a threat to them.
But it's also, I think, too, that these babies are raised in an urban environment. So that's the only environment they know. So they're getting cues from their mother. But at the same time, that's the only world they know, this urban world. So they adapt.
Exactly. Well. And they may already be genetically, you know, more bold to begin with. So, you know, you see this greater separation between urban and rural creatures.
Yeah, that's another study you should do, the difference between these two, the urban and not rural, but the wildlife.
Yeah.
Wildlife and environment. Well, we talked about evolution and resilience, and what is the impact, or what does it teach us about ourselves? What your study and your book, again, it's called Our Wild Familiars, How Animals Are Adapting to Cities and Reshaping the Natural World. What does it tell us about ourselves? Are we able to adapt to this interesting new world that we never thought about before? We may have been, as I mentioned in the beginning, somewhat subconsciously aware of all of these animals around us, but what does it teach us about ourselves?
Yeah, I mean, I think what I got out of doing the work on this book, and what I hope readers get out of it too, is we are not alone. You know, we don't have to leave cities to connect with nature. Nature is all around us, and we are participating in it. And to me, that feeling of connection is very powerful, and it stuck with me like doing the work on this book. And from the readers that have read this, I've heard the same thing, that, you know, they feel more connected to the world around them. And that's a beautiful thing. Beyond that, I think, you know, just recognizing that connection in cities can help us as a first step for a lot of people who feel completely overwhelmed by the changing climate and the changing planet and don't know how to even approach these issues. What I'm trying to convey in the book is that you don't have to approach this from a place of despair. You can approach this from a place of reverence and connection and intimacy if you just understand and sort of pursue and open yourself up to the ecosystem that you participate in cities. And from there, you know, you can build out from city environments a passion and a commitment to conservation that can start in urban areas and spread out from there.
I think the irony in all this is that I like your approach. And for example, if you're walking down the block and you're seeing nature, whether it's pigeons or other animals around you, and you get a sense of it. So there's the natural interaction with nature in a city, as you described it. And then there's the artificial one, which is called the zoo in most urban most urban environments, where it's much more structured and you don't really, you can see animals that you normally wouldn't see, such as an elephant, as I mentioned earlier, or a giraffe, but you don't see them in their natural environment. You're seeing them in a man-made structured environment. I like zoos, but what I'm saying is, and I think you understand what I'm saying, the natural world is much more real in an urban environment, walking down the street and observing nature that you can find anywhere, whether it's pigeons on the telephone wire, if they still have them around, or any of these other creatures that we talk about, that seems to be a more natural interaction than going to the zoo.
Yeah, you know what? I think the difference is that even when animals move into urban areas, they retain some ecological function. So often they, you know, I'll give you an example.
Sure.
There was a species of parrot in South America that has this key role in dispersing seeds across a forest, right? And so it eats the seeds, and as it eats it, it disperses the seeds of different plants. And that is an ecological function that keeps that ecosystem functioning. When those parrots move into urban environments, they lose that ecological function. So there is a shift sometimes, but the difference between animals in a zoo and animals in an urban environment is that those animals in an urban environment, even if their ecological functions change or shift or, you know, get lost and they get new ones, they're still part of an ecosystem. They're part of an ecosystem that we participate in as well. Whereas a zoo is not a real ecosystem. It is a, as you say, like a controlled environment in which all animals are effectively isolated from the ecosystems that they formerly participated in. And there's no way for them to adapt to anything new.
They're isolated from us and they're isolated from each other.
Yeah, exactly. And which is the opposite of what's happening in cities, right? Where
exactly. That was my
we're point. All thrown together, and it is... Like, this is not what nature planned for, you know, to have pigeons and raccoons and rats and coyotes and, you know, in the case of like L.A., exotic parrots that have, you know, been released and populated the skies. Like, it is all absurd and strange, but that doesn't make it, you know, that doesn't mean it's not beautiful and it's not worth preserving.
Well, that's a great way to leave it. My guest has been award-winning writer and social epidemiologist Dan Werb. He's author of Our Wild Familiars, How Animals Are Adapting to Cities and Reshaping the World. And they're available on Amazon, BarnesNobleBookshop.org and all the usual places. And for everything about Dan, go to danwerb.com, W-E-R-B, danwerb.com. And you can follow him on Instagram and Substack. And Dan, thanks for being on the show.
Thanks so much, Ira. I really appreciate it.
And join us every Thursday for a new schmear on Ira's Everything Bagel.